is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Greatly appreciate y'all joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. If you are so inclined, you can roll in with the usual suspects. That's a great way that if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or there are some questions you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's a great place to do it. We'll both be monitoring that during the course of the show and would love to bring in your ideas to the conversation. And if you got to head off and take care of some business before the show is over, remember, you can take a shortcut to just go to iTunes or Spreaker or any of the other podcast aggregators that you use and subscribe to the free podcast. That way, Midrats will be waiting for you whenever you want to. And if you realize you've missed some shows in the past, you can always jump back and grab them at that point. So enough of selling ourselves. We'll get to the show today. And we have got a great holiday treat for Midrats regulars because we've brought back one of our favorite guests. He's been a regular here almost from the start. I don't know if this is his fourth time back, maybe fifth. But anyway, this is an opportunity to talk to him about a different venue than we've had before. Not science fiction, not naval engineering, not program management, none of that stuff. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about our guest's latest employment opportunity he's been given the honor to take advantage of, and that involves the National Security Council. And while we're here, we're not just going to talk a bit about the National Security Council to maybe flesh it out more than what most people are aware of, but also going to talk about how the national security environment has changed during his tenure. And the guest for the full hour is going to be Mark R. Vandroff, Captain of the United States Navy. He is presently serving as the Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director, National Security, Director of Defense Policy and Strategy at the National Security Council. Mark, great to have you on board. Welcome back to Midrats.
Sal, thank you so much for that introduction. I think you forgot the very important retired after Captain United States Navy, which I occasionally wish I was back in uniform. I think a lot of retired folks do, but very much retired. There are active duty officers detailed to the National Security Council staff, and it's a great honor to interact with them, but I'm now one of the civilians. I'm one of the folks walking around wearing a suit there in the Eisenhower building, not walking around in Class A's. So
I appreciate you bringing that up. I can't complain about my teleprompter manager because I actually have that written down. I just didn't say it. So I do appreciate it because that's important because that's in your past. And, of course, as all of us who are retired, that flavors how we view things. But you are definitely a civilian, and you have been for a bit. And I believe we talked about that the last time you were on Midrats as well. And just to give people an idea how you got from there to here, how does a nice Annapolis grad, engineering duty officer, and mildly obsessive Florida Gators fan wind up at your position at the National Security Council?
Well, like a lot of things in life, I would have to attribute it to a combination of timing and luck. I retired after my tour at Carter Rock. I think the last time I was on your show was just before I ended my time on active duty, talked about Carter Rock, talked about the NAVSEA Enterprise and specifically what warfare centers did for NAVSEA. And then, like a lot of retiring naval officers, a very nice company that provides defense services, I'll give a shout-out to my old colleagues at Synetics LLC, offered me a position to continue my career in the business world, and I was doing that and quite happily doing that when my longtime good friend Robert O'Brien, who was a State Department official in the George W. Bush administration and a State Department official in the Trump administration, was named National Security Advisor. And a few months after that, he had a need, and he had an open, had come open, and he needed someone to help him there at the National Security Council staff. He called me, and as I've said often, or I've said often to my friends, I have a hard time saying no when my country tells me it's time to serve. So I left Synetics and have spent the last 10 months working on the National Security Council staff.
Well, first, I want to give you the chance to give a disclaimer as to whether these opinions or anything you say is, it just represents you or and not anything else, if you want to go with that.
I will say the standard disclaimer applies. I mean, I'm here with permission. This is not a bootleg operation. Any White House official who speaks in public has to clear the speaking engagement through the lawyers and through the White House comm shop, which I did. And but as always, what I am saying is my own opinion, does not represent the National Security Council or the Trump administration, but is represents just me.
Yeah, let me ask you about the National Security Council, because I think a lot of people are confused about what it is exactly, and talk about what it is and where you fit into the scheme of things over there.
So when we say National Security Council, I work on what is called the staff of the National Security Council. So let me put that in a parking lot. In 1947, established by law, in the series of defense reforms that happened at the end of World War II, the National Security Council was created. The statutory members of that are the president, the vice president, certain key cabinet officials, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Treasury, the Attorney General, certain key advisors that are statutory advisors, the Director of CIA, the Director of the National Intelligence, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president may direct other senior officials to attend the National Security Council if he wishes. Almost always, all presidents since the creation of the National Security Council have had a senior official in the White House with the title National Security Advisor. That's my boss, Ambassador Robert O'Brien. Every president that I can think of or that I found any information as I've researched archives that I was there always had the White House lawyer and the White House chief of staff attend the National Security Council meeting. To support the function of that council, the National Security Advisor maintains a staff. That staff has grown and shrunk in size as different administrations wanted to purpose the staff in different directions, and it's on that staff that I serve. There are different directorates within that staff. Some are what we call regional directorates, so they focus on a part of the world. Others are policy directorates. They focus on a particular type of national security policy. So defense policy and strategy is a policy directorate. You would think that a directorate would be headed by a director, but you would be wrong. The title of someone who heads a directorate on the National Security Council is a senior director. The directors are actually what we call the action, what in the Pentagon we would call an action officer, under the senior director. So within defense policy and strategy, I have directors for nuclear weapons policy and regular warfare and space policy and critical and emerging defense technology and foreign military sales and just generally those types of defense policy that would require interagency coordination. We can get into the interagency process a little bit. In fact, I'd like to talk about that maybe in the next question. But the next thing I'll say before I take the next question is to remember that the National Security Council staff is just that. It's a staff. If you think of the president as kind of the ultimate J00, the COCOM for the executive branch, the departments and agencies under that look like component commanders. So they're the ones in command. The person in command of the Defense Department is the Secretary of Defense. It's not me or anyone else on the National Security Council staff. It's my job to staff information up the chain of command to the president so that he's a well-informed executive branch COCOM, but the chain of command and the flow of decisions goes just like it does in the field. No one on SETCOM's staff has command over NAVSET. It's the three-star admiral that has command in NAVSET. The J-39 and the J-37 and the J-53, their job is to make sure that that J-00 is appropriately informed and that NAVSET and ArmySET and Air Force SET and SOC SET, that their actions are well coordinated with each other. That's the job of a staff. And if you think of the federal government, or at least the executive branch of the federal government as one big COCOM, you can think of the National Security Council staff as the J-3, J-5, sometimes J-8, and a little bit of J-2 within that organization.
Most of our listeners have some type of military background, and whether you come from a maritime, a land, or even an air side, whenever you're looking at a challenge, the smart people are reaching for a map. They're looking for a chart because geography matters, proximity matters. And one of the more interesting parts of our national security environment that I think is underappreciated is where the national security advisor himself is located relative to the president. Because a lot of people think about the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and they have great buildings and these huge staffs themselves. But there's something a little special about the national security advisor involving his physical space and proximity. I wonder if you could describe that for the listener.
Sure, and I'll tell a story that amplifies the importance of space that really has nothing to do with the National Security Advisor, and then I'll answer your question. So within the White House complex, we refer to it as the 18 acres, there are three large buildings. There's the White House, which everyone sees on TV, and that's what people think about when they think about the presidency. Across a parking lot that goes by the name West Executive Avenue, but it's not a street, it's a parking lot, is what historically has been called the old Executive Office Building, but about 20 years ago it was renamed the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. That's where my office is. And then across the street on the other side of Pennsylvania in the 70s, as the Executive Office of the President was growing to where the Eisenhower Building couldn't hold its entirety, a new building was built that is not surprisingly referred to as the new Executive Office Building, and the rest of the Executive Office of the President employees are there. So they're split between those three buildings. When they built the new Executive Office Building on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, the seventh floor was created this palatial, beautiful office space that had this sweeping view of all of Washington, and the seventh floor is up quite high. So you not only look down on the White House, but you just have this magnificent view. And they did it that way because the vision was that's where the vice president was going to have an office that was appropriate to the stature of the vice president, because the office that he had in the West Wing is kind of small and not particularly impressive. And even his office, his ceremonial office, in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building is small and a little dingy. So they wanted something for the vice president so that it would be appropriately impressive for an official of that seniority. Walter Mondale took one look at it and said, "I'm not leaving the West Wing," and never stepped foot in it, nor did any of Walter Mondale's successors. And today that office is occupied by a relatively junior and obscure member of the senior executive service within the Office of Management and Budget, because all of the political appointees would rather be closer to the Oval Office rather than give up their smaller offices for a bigger office space. So within the West Wing where the president works in the Oval Office, there is a corridor that comes out of the Oval Office, and as you pass it, you go by where usually some senior official, currently it's Jared Kushner's office is the first one you pass. You have then the White House Chief of Staff's office, the Vice President's West Wing office. You make a right, and then you step into the National Security Advisor's office. And that's the foursome of office space that is just feet away from the Oval Office so that you can just walk down the hallway, or in the case of the National Security Advisor, you can walk down the hallway and take a left, and you're right outside the Oval Office. Proximity is an advantage because although anyone who's been on a staff knows that, if you are an 06 on a four-star staff, you're not in command of any of those three-star component commanders. You're not their boss, but you do have the advantage of being able to talk to the four-star on a regular basis, depending upon your role. And that regular basis can give you access and insight and influence to a greater degree than perhaps your peers elsewhere within that four-star's scope of authority.
I wanted to ask a question. You asked us to ask earlier about the coordination function, I think, of the National Security Council and the staff. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So to give an idea of what actually goes on at the National Security Council, let me define some terms. Most of your listeners who previously served in a military service are probably familiar with the terms instructions and notices. So an instruction is some permanent piece of policy that someone in command has issued, and then you have a notice, which is a written direction from someone in command, but usually temporary in scope and temporary in effect. It's something to handle what's going on right now. It's not intended to be something that's permanent. Within the national security world, I'm going to use the term NSPM, which stands for National Security Presidential Memorandum. Interestingly enough, the same thing goes by a different term in every presidential administration. So in the Obama administration, you had PPD, Presidential Policy Directives, and in the George W. Bush, I believe they were NSD, National Security Directives. The presidents do not change them every time there's a new president out of vanity. Actually, Presidential Records Management always crafts a new acronym so that when the internal website that shows effective instructions are posted, you can tell at a glance which administration they came from. And then this website maintains a list of effective and ineffective. So, for example, if there was a PPD from the Obama administration, and then that was changed in the Trump administration, the NSPM that changed it would go to the effective, and the PPD would go to the retired. But unless it's specifically retired or rescinded or changed by a later instruction, all of them remain permanent policy for the executive branch. NSPM 4, so it was changed relatively early in the Trump administration, talked about is the instruction for how the interagency will coordinate with each other, how you bring together the State Department and the intelligence community and the Defense Department and the Treasury and the Justice Department in order to get a whole of government approach towards any given issue that needs coordination amongst the agencies. The highest decision-making body for that is the National Security Council, but not every issue goes to the National Security Council. So it establishes a chain, NSPM 4, of subordinate bodies to the National Security Council for the purpose of coordinating amongst the different departments and agencies. The first body under the National Security Council is what's called the Principals Committee. That's the National Security Advisor and Cabinet Secretaries. The next layer under that is called the Deputies Committee. Not unsurprisingly, it's the Deputy National Security Advisor and Deputy Cabinet Secretary. And then at the bottom, you have what I run, what's called a Policy Coordination Committee, which is a senior director, one or more senior directors from the National Security Council, and then usually under an assistant secretary or sometimes deputy assistant or deputy undersecretaries from various departments and agencies. For anyone who ever did defense acquisition back in the Pentagon, this should strike them as very familiar. In defense acquisition in the, under the DoD 5000, the ultimate decision maker is the Undersecretary of Defense for acquisition and sustainment. And the Undersecretary runs what's called the defense acquisition. Others come together to make major acquisition policy decisions for the Department of Defense. But there are subordinate groups, what's called a working IPT and an integrating IPT and an overarching IPT, where you get go from junior to more senior people so that issues can get vetted, talked about, stakeholders engaged, and then you, what you ultimately get is options for that undersecretary to make a decision. Policymaking for national policy, I have found, and that's why it was interesting. When I got there, I said to myself, what is someone with a career in defense acquisition doing in a policy job in the National Security Council? But I found my acquisition background actually prepared me quite well because many of the skill sets were the same, even if the issues were different. Because in the end, you still had to engage stakeholders, you had to surface issues, you had to come up with options to deal with those issues, and then you had to vet them up the chain of command until you got to a decision maker. The difference between a DAB and the National Security Council is the level of seniority of the decision maker. In one case, it's an undersecretary. In the case of the NSPM-4 process, it's the President of the United States. But the process of identifying issues, gathering information, coming up with options, and then presenting those options in a meaningful way so that the decision makers can make informed decisions, very similar, and I felt like I was well prepared by my time in acquisition for the policy job that I've been doing.
I kind of had to wonder how many of our guests, while you were talking, were taking the whiteboard out and were trying to diagram all the, because it's a complicated system that we have, the bureaucracy. And, you know, a few years ago, there was a lot of writing and gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes while screaming, the interagency, because in the 70-plus years since the National Security Council was birthed by Truman, I believe, it's grown. And I wanted to, if you could, just talk for a bit about the size of the National Security Council and the challenges or the advantages of that size, but also talk a bit about the bureaucracy. What's the mix of military to civilian? And of those civilians, how many of them are permanent party? How many of them are political opponents, political appointees? And have there been some moves as of late to look at the size and the bureaucratic requirements of the job to get something a little more efficient? Because I don't see how our world is really dramatically that much more complicated than what Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy had to face.
So you've hit upon one of my boss, Ambassador O'Brien's priorities during his time as National Security Advisor. What I will say is the National Security Council staff is historically as big as the president has wanted it to be. And some presidents have gotten with as far as few as 40 to 50 professionals. I'm going to not count in this number support staff, and I'm also going to not count the, even though it falls under the National Security Advisor, the duty officers at the White House Situation Room. So the White House Situation Room, which we can talk a little bit about later, falls under the National Security Advisor. You have an organization that runs that, and there are intelligence officers and communications and watch officers and communications specialists that run the Situation Room, not only so that it's an effective meeting space, but it's also the watch floor for the White House. So it's in comms with the National Military Command Center and the equivalent organizations at State and CIA, so that information flows in a real time, and there's always a duty officer there. And that team, I'm excluding that from the policy-making professionals. Right now on the National Security Council, we have roughly 120 or so, maybe a few less, policy professionals, people that are actually, whose job it is to coordinate policy amongst the interagency, turn that into documented policy, and get that stacked up for decisions. We have that across about a dozen directorates. Six of those are regional, and then the rest of them are functional. So the regions are split up more or less the way the State Department splits up the world, not quite the way that the COCOMs are split up. So regional, you have Western Hemisphere, then you have Africa, you have the Middle East and North Africa, South and Central Asia, East Asia and the Pacific, Europe and Russia. So those are the six regions of the world. And then within policy, you have things like defense, intelligence programs, resilience and homeland security, border and transportation security, cybersecurity, weapons of mass destruction and biodefense. So those are the different types of policy. And then we work together between the regionals and the policy directorates. So, if, you know, roughly 10 people per directorate if you have 120 professionals and roughly a dozen directorates. And then we also have support, and I'm not counting the support staff. So you have human resources and admin and lots of lawyers to come to every meeting and check everything that you do, and public relations and legislative affairs. I'm not counting that support staff. It has been as large as 250 policy professionals during the Obama administration. I think it reached its peak. How much you want to do with the National Security Council and how much you want to just give an issue to a department and agency and say, run with it, we're not going to do any cross-agency coordination from the White House, is a choice that every administration makes. Under Ambassador O'Brien, we've tried to get to the number that was roughly what was staffed out and roughly the organization in the first 4 years of George W. Bush. 120 is a manageable number. We want to maintain good interagency coordination and accurate and timely information flow up the chain of command. But what we don't want to do is try and do the Department of Defense, the Department of State, or the Director of National Security, or the Secretary of Homeland Security's jobs for them. And when you get the National Security Council too large, there is always that push to do that. As far as who is on the National Security Council, the National Security Advisor, the Deputy National Security Advisor, are White House political appointees. Several of the senior directors, but not all, are also White House political appointees. Some are what we would call Schedule C employees. So they were hired as a political appointee at State or the DNI or the Department of Defense, and then detailed for 1 or 2 year details over to the National Security Council. They're on loan. So, for example, for most of the time, well, right now, my colleague, who is the senior director for European Affairs, he was a Schedule C, so a political hire in the State Department, but he is a State Department employee on loan to us. At the director level, you get detailees. So these are all people who are on loan to us from another agency. There are very few White House employees, permanent White House employees on the National Security Council staff. But many of those are not Schedule C or another form of political appointee. They are career in either military officers in the case of the Coast Guard or the Department of Defense, or their career civil servants or career foreign service or career intelligence officers coming from the State Department or the intelligence community. And for them, a 1 or 2 year detail at the National Security Council is a career development tool. And I will say this as a, you know, my commitment to the Navy and how much I love the Navy after my 30 years there. My experience has been that of all the services, the Air Force does a really good job of both screening its officers to come to the White House, but also of strategically trying to compete to place Air Force officer detailees into spots on the National Security Council where they can do good work, but where also they will be able to make sure that the Air Force is well thought of at critical times. I would advise the Army and the Navy, if there anyone from there is listening to this, that they may want to think about upping their game in the next administration. for just not that I haven't served with a number of wonderful naval officers who are currently detailed to the NSC staff, or wonderful Army officers. They are wonderful, but the Air Force is extremely strategic. And my first week in office, the Vice Chief of Staff called me up to talk about Air Force manning at the National Security Council to make sure that he had his officers placed both where I needed them, but frankly where he needed them as well for their professional growth. The civilians, some are from DOD, but again, others from the State Department or the different parts of the intelligence community. Within the Defense Policy Directorate, all of my detailees are from DOD. I have six or seven uniformed officers and one DOD civil servant. And then they'll all go back when their detail is up and back to their jobs in the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, SOCOM, wherever they are. And then the services will propose the next batch of detailees. And that's true for all the other directorates as well. Certainly within the regions, folks with an intelligence background or a foreign area officer background tend to be highly valued because just that's the kind of work that that they're doing. I am hopeful, after my experience, to get a broader range of folks looked at for possible details because I think that a lot of different experiences within what you do in the military can be very useful to the policymakers on the National Security Council. That's been one of the lessons I've taken away from my last 10 months there.
Let me track a little bit the need for a policy. I assume there are certain policies which exist because they've always existed, like nuclear weapons, say. But and I assure those somebody has to review those and make sure they're current and all that stuff. But how does a new policy, something pops up? Where's the pop-up policy come from, and what's the flow of that up the food chain that you deal with?
So let me give you an example. Unfortunately, I could give quite a few examples. Let me give something that I can at least talk about publicly because it's been publicly released. So one of the things that was recognized, and this was an administration priority, was critical and emerging technologies within both defense and non-defense, that for a country, its national security is dependent upon its ability to field top-rate technology. And a lot goes into that. That there's an industrial-based component, there's an educational component, there's a human capital component. So the question is, what can we do to make sure that, A, our critical and emerging technology continues to lead the world? And two, what about protecting our critical and emerging technology from being exploited by potential adversary nations or bad actors? The Trump administration recently published an NSPM and a public strategy for critical and emerging technology. And that was one of the things that the Defense Directorate was on point for. Now, if you think about it, there's a lot of people that have a role in critical and emerging technology. Certainly, the Department of Defense is very interested in that when it comes to high tech. But when it comes to protecting our technology, well, there's issues of classification, which is generally defense, but there's a counterintelligence, which is the intelligence community. There are import and export controls involved in that, which is the Department of Commerce. There's the licensing of what we will and won't sell in a foreign military sales case, which is the Department of State. And I don't think I put in Treasury there, but they came to the meetings, and there were a few others. And then when it comes to the promotion of critical and emerging technology and the human capital, within the federal government, you have the Office of Personnel Management. And for STEM technology policy more broadly, you have the Department of Education. If we left everyone to say, hey, critical and emerging technology, go make it happen, would you have any expectation that state and commerce and education and DOD and the intelligence community would stay on the same page without some guidance with which to do that? Well, we made some interagency policies. So how do you do that? First, we get the tasking that this is important. Now, sometimes we self-create tasking. Hey, we think this is important. Let's get our bosses excited about this. But many times this is either a priority of the administration or something that's recognized. So it's time for us to come up with policy. We have these policy coordination committee meetings. We work at the, let's call it the assistant secretary level, the senior subject matter experts. They're being supported by subject matter experts in each of the areas in their departments and agencies to say, what are the things that we can propose? What are the issues? What would look like a good policy for that? And then we draft that, we write that. If it's a NFPM, think of that as writing an instruction and chopping it around everyone that's going to have to execute that instruction. I talked about the departments and agencies, but there would also be other interested parts of the executive office of the president. So, for example, the president has an Office of Science and Technology Policy. So in the case of critical emerging technology, they were obviously heavily involved. To the extent we have to pay for any of this, the Office of Management and Budget has to be involved. So all of those players, you get a nice crowded conference room in a secure VTC, and you talk about how are we going to engage on that. You come up with something that either is a consensus or you surface where there's not a consensus, and then you vet that up the chain of command to get a decision to, hey, we have a consensus, does our chain concur with us, or we have a difference, which way does the leadership want to go? That thing gets vetted up, and then you go and you basically, just like a service secretary or the Secretary of Defense would sign out a defense instruction, DOD instruction, or a SECNAV instruction, the president signs out the strategy, he signs out the national security, the NFPM National Security Policy Memorandum. Those that are unclassified get published and they all get distributed to the agencies. If they're classified, they get distributed to the agencies over JWIC. But something that's unclassified will always make the effort to be as transparent as possible. They get distributed to the agencies. In the case of critical emerging technology, we actually did a press release and had an unclassified annex to give out. And that then becomes the guidance and the policy for the different department agencies to engage in this area. Now, I just described something that was unclassified. I will describe another one that I cannot talk about any specifics, but let me give talking generalities. When I got to my job, there was a issue between DOD and the intelligence community that I was worried that was not going to go well because the two of them were diverging. Now, luckily, the principals involved were very good at the senior level, but some of the junior folks were being overly parochial. And on the National Security Council, we talk about the power to call a meeting. I had no authority to tell anyone at DOD that what they were doing was stupid, but what I did have the authority to do was say we were going to have a meeting at this in which the Deputy Secretary of Defense was going to have to attend. And if they wanted to be stupid in front of their own Deputy Secretary, they could be my guest. And that made them reconsider their actions. And when we actually got to the meeting, I was presented with a path forward that seemed way better thought out than what I had discovered at first. So another thing that the National Security Council will do is cause management attention to be focused where sometimes management attention is needed. I didn't have any authority to tell them what they were doing didn't make sense, but DepSec Def Norquist did, and we were able to solve a problem. So that's another example of what good interagency coordination can do. Even if we're at the National Security Council, not the ones in the chain of command, sometimes we can get someone more senior in the chain of command to take a look at something and say, is this really what you want to do? The good news is I found that the cabinet secretaries and the deputy cabinet secretaries all seem to be pretty none of them got there by accident. They're all pretty smart, pretty responsible folks. And even if down the food chain they'll occasionally have some stray voltage, once it comes to their attention, they're pretty good at getting it under control. Sometimes you get disagreements at the deputy and principal's level just because the question is hard and the interests are many, and that's just the nature of policymaking. Really tough questions don't get solved at a lower level because they need a higher level of direction, but even once you get up to that higher level of direction, the problems don't magically get easy. You just get the people with the authority to make the harder call. But hard problems tend to stay hard problems.
And that tied flows in perfectly to the question I wanted to ask for you, because it's not easy, it's not hard, and the consequences for being wrong in the national security arena can border on the nightmarish. A lot of people age very fast in that line of work. And you started the conversation talking about technology, and bad theory brings bad policy, and a lot of times, in hindsight, the bad theories seem bad, but at the time, everybody thought they were great ideas, or you happen to find yourself someplace where there was nobody at the table there to disagree with any force. And on a regular basis, it's not a new phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination. A new idea comes up or a new concept that gets a fever pace where people are so excited about it, and a lot of times it is technologically based. People think they've found a way to make the hard problem easy, and what in reality turns out to be a supporting concept or operation, they say, this is your answer to all your problems. This is going to transform everything and change everything. All we need to do is buy this. And a lot of fifth-generation warfare advocates kind of fit that angle. How often do y'all run into or have to battle the sarcastic person, we'll call them the good idea fairy, those that are real zealots in one particular area? Or is that structure and that interagency process designed as such that it can mitigate those spikes in ideas as they come in?
So one thing I will say about the interagency process is that just like everything else in life, it is staffed by human beings. All of us who have our own human flaws and weaknesses. And you just described one, and there are others. There are people that fall in love with the sound of their own voice. There are people that think that whatever it is that they are working on or their pet project will solve everything. I would like to tell you that the interagency process is perfect so that none of that ever gets through and no bad ideas are ever presented to leadership. I've been personally reasonably to very proud of what I have seen within that process. But again, the interagency process is also staffed by, you know, at every level, from the highest down to the working level, we're all human beings. That means none of us are perfect. That means not all of our ideas are going to be good, and that everyone has the normal set of human foibles to tend to look at and say, oh no, I have all the answers, whether or not they do. And that's common wherever you look, and there's no magic way of avoiding that. Like I said, the senior folks that I've been privileged to work with and brief at the cabinet level and deputy cabinet level are all very dedicated. They're all very intelligent, but they're all also human beings, right? Just like we all are. So, there's no magic knowledge. There's no special sauce. There's no, hey, here's the way that you can guarantee that nobody ever gets a bad idea. That just doesn't exist. In a good process, which I think we have, and a disciplined process, you can make sure that all voices get heard, so that if there's someone who's a legitimate stakeholder to a process, and that they've got something to say, they get to say that, and they get to say that at the appropriate level. So I have seen, and again, most of this is national security, therefore specifics tend to be something that I want to talk about on a public podcast, but I have seen plenty of times where there were disagreements at very senior levels, and those disagreements had to be taken up the chain of command for a senior decision, and every time, someone might have thought they were right, and someone might have thought they were wrong, but every time, everyone got their say, and that's what the interagency process is for. It would have been wrong to say, pick your department, State Department, we're not going to care what you think, or Defense Department, we don't care what you think, or Treasury or Justice, we don't care what you think. That would be wrong. It's one thing if you have different ideas coming from each of those and the relevant officials get to make their best case for, hey, I think we need to do it this way. And then, you know, the person who's empowered to make the decision, and that ultimately flows up to the president, then gets to make the decision. But the I have all the processes that I've been involved with, everybody who had a reason to have an opinion at least got their opinion to state. There's no perfect way that will filter out all bad information, because frankly, we don't know what bad information is until after the fact. And bad ideas don't come clearly labeled as bad ideas. Many of them that we look back in hindsight, 2020 hindsight, say, you know, that didn't make any sense. At the time, had some level of attractiveness to it. So, you know, I have sympathy for the administrations that came before us, and I have tremendous sympathy for folks who had my job before me, and I wish the best for all for the folks who will have my job after me. It's not easy, and everyone, all you can ask any of them to do is to do the best they can while they're in the seats, trying to do what it takes to advance American interests and keep Americans safe.
It sounds like you did an incredible amount of getting up a high rate of speed to get up to speed for your job. That's part one. How much work did you actually do to get ready to be in this position? And secondly, what was the biggest surprise you ran into or have run into so far in your position?
So I did have a lot of work to do to get up to speed, but I will say the staff that was there. And so I relieved a gentleman named Earl Matthews. There was actually another gentleman named Tom Williams who had the job in an acting capacity. But Earl had been the senior director for defense for 2 years, and he was on a two-year detail from the Department of the Army. So he was a senior Schedule C, so think, you know, senior SES equivalent, detailed to the National Security Council for 2 years. He left and went back after his 2 years, and then I was brought in as a White House employee to backfill Earl. And I've said this to him, and this will give me a chance to say it publicly. He made my job incredibly easy because he had managed to pick a staff that was incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly patient. So when I came in, things that I had had very little exposure to, I had a staff that got me up to speed very quickly through no skill of my own, but just because they were so spectacular and wonderful. One of the things I will say, though, is that I was well served by my time on active duty, because not unlike, say, within the Navy, when I worked for Deputy Assistant Secretary to the Navy, my job was pretty similar to what a Deputy Assistant Secretary does. I had action officers who were subject matter experts. My job was to collate their knowledge, combine that with other stakeholders, and then get it up the chain of command in a way that was timely and relevant and useful for the senior decision makers to make the decision. And that skill set I learned when I was working in the Pentagon. And I think that for anyone who had a meaningful tour in the Pentagon, in the OPNAV staff or the joint staff or on the staff of one of the service secretaries, if they got plopped into the National Security Council staff, they would fairly quickly find themselves at home. The difference is you learn to not be intimidated when the person who wants a brief is the Vice President of the United States, as opposed to some assistant secretary. And the first time it's the president or the vice president, you get your knees buckle a little bit. And then after you do it for a while, that's who you brief. So you go in and again, you collect information, you synthesize it, you present it, much like folks on military staffs or other government staffs have been doing since time immemorial. So that's what brought me as far as doing the work. My staff really did a wonderful job of getting me up to speed on the issues, but the concept of staffing issues up the chain of command, I came there with that skill set. I had learned it earlier in my career in the Pentagon. As far as the biggest surprise, I guess, and it had to do with the world of intelligence. So I will not be able to talk about it at great length, but it was the first time that I was exposed to such a broad level of our national intelligence capability. When I was at Carter Rock, we were working on things to counter different threats. I was, comparatively deep in what we knew about the threats we were trying to counter, but it wasn't broad scope. So looking at the breadth of what the intelligence community has to try and collect on, synthesize, and come up with useful information for senior decision makers, that was if not a surprise, because I could have guessed it, but that was a very much a new experience, and it gave me a new appreciation for what the U.S. intelligence community has to do day in and day out.
Eagle One?
I thought I just asked that question. I think it's your turn.
Oh, I got lost.
Well coordinated show.
Let me give you a chance to toot a little horn here, because during your tenure, something happened that reminded me of a whole series of events. And there's a lot of talk about this is a non-political term, I think, the bipartisan consensus in foreign policy, or just the foreign policy consensus, perhaps, or the establishment in the foreign policy world and the things they believe that are true. And, one thing you have in D.C. and academia in large are people that have been at this, that a lot of academic and a lot of practical for many of them practice in the national security arena. However, the foreign policy establishment did not see the fall of the USSR. They, some did, but they were the minority. Saw the malignant possibilities of a rise of China. And I think the latest example, and I'll just mention his name because he was the most prominent person to say it, former Secretary of State John Kerry stated perfectly, I think, the foreign policy established about the Middle East a couple of years ago, where he said the only way you can grow peace in the Middle East is by first solving the Palestinian and Israeli question. And until that is done, he can't do anything else. Well, one of the great successes in the last year have been the Abraham Accords, which really went counter in a variety of ways what many of at least those with the largest voices in the national security arena in D.C. in the last decade or so have been saying. Talk a little bit about the power, and not so much the power, the good side, the utility of that type of tenure and that type of deep establishment, and some of the shortfalls that are out there as a byproduct of it as well. And are there other areas out there that probably are not, for lack of a better phrase, settled science in the national security arena as we think that you are? Do you think there might be other opportunities to take a different route to achieve the same end?
So let me talk. Thanks for asking about the Abraham Accords. And I'll use that as an example to try and tee up some of the questions that you asked within the Abraham Accords. But I'll also use that as an example to talk about Ambassador O'Brien's philosophy of what the National Security Council needs to be, or should be, I should say, and what our functions are. So I got to work on the Abraham Accords, which will be a highlight of my life. And if I worked on nothing else in the time that I was on the NSC staff, the Abraham Accords were worth it. I was not, by any stretch of the imagination, a critical player in the Abraham Accords. I got to work on it, but I am very confident that any other competent senior director in my position could have done the tasking that I needed to do for my little part. I just happened to be the lucky one that was there. There were a few indispensable people, and I'll mention them as I talk about the Abraham Accords. trying to improve the situation in the Middle East had been a Trump administration priority, and he assigned that to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and one of Jared Kushner's very senior staff members, a gentleman by the name of Avi Berkowitz. And I'll digress for just a moment, because Jared gets a lot of negative press, and I think that's unfortunate. People can have whatever opinions they want to have, but in the White House, the rank structure below the president and the vice president goes by the title assistant to the president, deputy assistant to the president, and then special assistant to the president. And that's your descending structure. So the most senior aides are assistants to the president. And among the assistants to the president, the most senior has always been the big three have always been the White House chief of staff, the national security advisor, and the lawyer, whoever the White House counsel is. But most administrations have had a fourth, call it minister without portfolio. So in the Obama administration, that was Valerie Jarrett. In the George W. Bush administration, that was Karl Rove. And in this administration, that's Jared Kushner. There's usually one assistant to the president who doesn't have a specific portfolio, but is someone whose judgment the president trusts and can speak candidly for the president, because we always count on him to understand the president's thinking, and that assistant to the president is usually part of that inner group, and every administration seems to have one. So there's kind of nothing unusual about that having been Jared in the Trump administration. Jared is a businessman and because of that, he looked at the Middle East with a fresh set of eyes. I think that there were probably times that I drove Jared a little crazy as we were working on the Abraham Accords, because 30 years in the Defense Department and specifically in the Navy, I tended to see things in government way. I would say things like, well, we'll have to run this process, or we'll need this particular bureaucracy to line up if we want to try something. And he would get kind of rightfully frustrated because he viewed that bureaucracy as an impediment to get real work done. And in many cases, he was not wrong about that. Government operates the way it does, which gets back to what was the job of the National Security Council. The job of Jared was to implement the president's policy. His policy was get the Middle East to a better place, try and get to a point where you could have normalization between Israel and additional Arab countries in the region that would benefit the U.S. security, first and foremost, benefit the U.S. security posture, benefit the region, continue to put pressure on Iran, who we view as a bad actor and an unhelpful actor, and try to empower the responsible states within the region, or those states that wanted to play a more constructive role. Jared had that mission. The National Security Council, we were his staff and we were his support. When he said he would come back from trips in the Middle East and it would be the State Department needs to do this, well, we now need the Defense Department to do that to continue to advance that. It became our job on the National Security Council to then do that interagency coordination for Jared and Avi so that they could keep being successful. Our job was to do the block and tackling. We were not making the policy. The policy was being made by the president and his team. Our job was to execute that tasking and to make sure that the different parts of the government that had tasking to execute to keep moving towards what eventually became the Abraham Accords were capable of doing that and properly coordinated, because that's what we do. The National Security Council is there to coordinate the actions of the departments and agencies. So we weren't making policy. We were doing the blocking and the tackling and the executing for the people that were actually making the policy that became the Abraham Accords. I will say there was one member of the National Security Council staff who was absolutely indispensable. I don't know the counterfactual if we would have gotten the outcome we did without him, but one of the military officers detailed to the National Security Council, an Army general officer by the name of Miguel Carrera, who now a major general, but during his one-star tour was as our attaché, our defense attaché in Abu Dhabi. And from that time, as an attaché, he knew all the members of the royal family. He knew all the members of the senior defense staff. He knew many of the folks in the foreign ministry of the United Arab Emirates. They knew him. He knew them, and that gave us a basis so that as Jared was working and as we were doing the work, we felt like through Miguel we had a great deal of awareness so that we didn't make missteps and we understood the Emirati much better for what their needs were in that whole process because we had Miguel advising us. That was just, you know, the circumstance of the right placed military officer. If we had had someone on staff who had been the attaché to anywhere else in the world, it would have been certainly, I'm sure that flag or general officer would have still worked just as hard and still been a team player, but we were so fortunate to have General Correa in the right place at the right time, given his experiences as the attaché. But to get back to the real point of your question, I think the fact that Jared is a businessman and not a former ambassador, not a career foreign service officer, not someone who came up having served on the CENTCOM staff, but who looked at it with a businessman's eye, did provide new opportunities in making progress. I think the magic of the National Security Council, if he still needed those skill sets, he still needed folks who had been career foreign service officers and folks who knew how CENTCOM operated and folks who knew what went on in embassies to help him accomplish what he ultimately accomplished. And that was where we came in the National Security Council. We provided that expertise to go with the fresh set of eyes to get something new done. And I would say that that's an effective lesson, certainly in government and maybe in a lot of things in life. When you get the chance to have someone take a look with a fresh set of eyes, you can make great progress at things, but it can't be a fresh set of eyes unaided by any information about what's going on. Ideally, it's a fresh set of eyes being informed by expertise, but bringing in that separate perspective, that separate look that can really achieve a breakthrough.
Well, first I want to thank you for giving us this glimpse under the skirts of the National Security Council and its staff. And as I used to do when I was back practicing law, I'll ask you a question that I used to end depositions with. Is there anything we didn't ask you that you would like to discuss right now that we could, because we'll keep you here as long as we can, Mark, but is there anything else you'd like to throw out while we've got you?
Well, you know, I mean, thank you, Eagle, for that. And I could keep talking about, I started off with a whole list here of things I wanted to talk about or notes about what I thought you might ask me. And that's, I think I covered all of the ones that I thought were absolutely vital. It's an interesting experience working in the center there, the National Security Council, as part of the White House staff. It was an honor of a lifetime for me to do this. On one level, it's incredible because you work with a bunch of incredible people. And I really hold many, many of my colleagues in very, very high regard. And like a lot of places, when you work somewhere, the friendships you make and the people you meet are always the best part. The other thing that I want to tell folks is that like everywhere else, if I am sure that many of your listeners served in the military or in a lot of different hierarchical organizations, were at places where, wow, I had these really wonderful colleagues, and then I had some colleagues I couldn't stand, and it was a bell curve. And you always had a few people that were just superstars, and a few people, it's like, how the heck did I end up dealing with this clown? And then most of the people in the middle of that bell curve were competent and hardworking and trying to do the best they could amidst all of the normal human failings that we all have. And I would say that what I now know is no matter how high up you go up the chain of command, that's still true. There's still a bell curve. There's still some that are wonderful. There's a few that you look at of like, how did they get here? And most, the vast majority of people are trying to do the best they can. They're giving it their all. They're very talented and very motivated. People don't always see eye to eye. That's very true in Washington, very true in politics. But I was reassured that people are doing the best they can, and I think that's true across both sides of the aisle. I am sure that the next team that comes in, they will be doing the best they can with the people they think are the best people for the job. I will say, and this is something, and I'm not meaning to be controversial, so I'll try and make it as non-controversial and as not political as possible. Philosophy matters, and it matters more than people think. You can get someone who's very, very competent, and if they're very, very competent but have the wrong idea about what a different idea about what should be done, very competent people trying to get a different thing done will have a very different outcome. And I guess ultimately that's why we have elections. But I now also understand the importance of what a change of philosophy will do from one administration to another in a way that I probably never appreciated before. If you want to talk more, I can talk about White House organization and just possibly bore the crap out of all of your listeners. I can certainly talk more specifics about anything that national security wise that you want to talk about. Let me take one specific to what I said there at the end, because one of the things we did while I was there, in addition to the Abraham Accords, that I'm pretty proud of, that a lot of people were very unhappy with, is that was something that was within my involvement. The United States pulled out of the Open Sky Treaty. That was recent, and that was public. We took some criticism internationally for that, and we've taken some criticism domestically for that. And we've also had those that supported us. How you view a treaty is a policy choice. And I can tell you that in this administration, the way the president and the Trump administration views a treaty is that it's a contract between sovereign entities. That's what a treaty is. There are those that would say, no, a treaty is a symbol. So we sign a treaty to show that we are leading in a certain area, or so that we have a stake in the way the other treaty signatories conduct themselves. That, you know, we sign a treaty to show that to signal what is and isn't important to us as a nation. If you believe that that's the role of a treaty, then that's a policy choice, and I'm just going to choose to disagree with you. A treaty is a contract between two sovereigns. If I sign a contract as a person with another legal entity, then I expect there to be consideration and performance on both sides. I'm giving up something, the other side is giving up something, and in the end, we both get something out of it that's described in the treaty. If I pay someone to build my house and they don't build the house, the fact that, well, I can't break this contract now, even though my house isn't getting built, because it might send the wrong signal to all my neighbors, is not the way we approach a contract, and it's not the way we approach a treaty. In the case of the Open Skies Treaty, you know, we felt like it was a contract that wasn't being adhered to, so we're not going to live up to it. You know, so we're not going to participate in a contract that one side's not living up to. We're not getting the advantage out of it, or we're not getting the consideration. Forget the word advantage. We're not getting the consideration in a bilateral contract that we expected when we actually signed it. So that contract's not worth staying in. That's a policy choice. So in the future, ask yourself, should treaties be contracts or treaty symbols? And how you believe might color how you vote. But that's the kind of philosophical consideration that ends up being policy, that ends up influencing how an administration conducts its business. And that's also one example that I got to be at the center at, and work on while I was there working on the National Security Council. So hopefully that example was helpful.
It absolutely does. Ideas and people matter. And, you know, Mark, it's been great having you on. when things work their course and you get ready for the other chapter, we'll have to chat and have you on again, because I think you'll have some other great stuff our listeners will enjoy listening to when we get to that point. And hey, we're coming near the end of the year. I know you've had an eventful year and got a few more months going, but I wish the best for you and your family as we come into the holiday seasons, and look forward to the next opportunity to talk.
Absolutely, Sal. Thank you for having me on the podcast. Thank you, Eagle, for your questions. I will say that I tend to now do podcasts with you every time I'm getting ready to leave a job. I tell you what it was like. I told you what it was like being a program manager, and then I told you what it was like to have command of a warfare center. Now I've told you what it was like on the National Security Council. Part of me hopes after the next, I don't talk to you for a while, because whatever my next job is, I'd like to keep it for a while this time. But hopefully we'll have other things that that we can talk about. And the next time I'm in your neck of the woods, Sal, I hope to see you with, hopefully it'll be by the time we can actually have good face-to-face, human-to-human, post-COVID contact, so we can relax over a beer and a cigar and tell more sea stories.
We'll keep our fingers crossed for your next job being more long-lasting.
Well, you have a very interesting life.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, we hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.